Hello and welcome back to the London Magazine podcast. I'm Jamie Cameron, managing editor here at the magazine. I'm joined by our editorial and marketing assistant, Katie Tobin. Katie, hello.
Hello, hello.
We are delighted to be joined by no less Claire Carroll, regular London Magazine contributor, who writes experimental fiction about the intersection of nature, technology and desire. She's also a PhD researcher at Bath Spa and Exeter Universities, where she explores how experimental writing, particularly short stories and prose poetry, can reimagine how humans relate to the natural and non-human world. Alongside the London Magazine, Claire has published short stories, poetry in a variety of journals. I won't list all of them, but you're shortlisted for the White Review Short Story Prize.
Yeah.
Your short story, Cephalopod?
Cephalopod.
Cephalopod. God, that's absolutely butchered by me. Won the Essex University and Short Fiction Journal Wild Writing Prize. So many prizes. Claire, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm okay. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. To start things off, we're going to have you read a story from your new collection, The Unreliable Nature Writer. This story was actually first published in the London Magazine maybe March last year, around that time, maybe January. It is called Infinite Husbands. Claire, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Thank you. Infinite Husbands. I'll let you in on a little secret. I have a lot of husbands. I don't have time to tell you about all of them, but we could talk about some, maybe 10, unless I get tired and then I'll stop telling you about them. Please don't be under any illusion that these are the most important husbands or the most recent, and please don't ask me any questions about how I maintain a life with so many husbands. That's none of your business. My first husband is handsome but quick to emotion. When I first met him, he cried a lot about how his mother had abandoned him as a child. She ran off with a swimming instructor and was never seen again. His father couldn't cope. As a result, my first husband was very needy, but I looked after him. I gave him what he needed, gave him what he hadn't had from his mother. And in time, he became less needy. We don't see each other very often nowadays, but he knows I love him. My second husband is hilarious and cruel and devastatingly handsome with watery blue eyes. He is so handsome that I can't even think about him for too long as my heart rate rises unbearably and I have to lie down. He's been missing for quite some time. My third husband looks exactly like me in every way, to the point where we are often mistaken for the same person. He likes me to cut my hair very short to match his. This can upset the other husbands, but not one of them is brave enough to fight husband number three over it. He's prone to aggressive outbursts. Once we were in a pub having Sunday lunch when a man at the next table bumped into husband number three, spilling some of his drink onto our table. Before I knew what was happening, husband number three had jumped up and flung his own drink, glass and all, into the man's face. The man screamed and my husband roared back at him. My husband was eventually dragged from the pub by two police officers, his shirt ripped and covered in the man's blood. I bought him that shirt. It was a Paul Smith one. My fourth and fifth husbands are twins, two sides of the same coin. They're musicians in a band together. One plays the drums and the other sings. Now, I know what you're thinking and you can stop right there. It's not all like that. They hate being fetishized in that way. They are very sweet boys, sweet men, beautiful mirror images. I prefer one over the other, but I would never tell them which, or you, so you can stop asking. My sixth husband is very elusive, but is by far one of the most intelligent men I have ever met. He lives near the sea. It's a long journey, but I visit whenever I can. He works as a scientist, monitoring the ocean for pollution levels. The house he lives in dates from the early 20th century and is an excellent example of the Art Deco style, with huge windows that look out over the beach. The light inside the house is exquisite. The sun bounces off the sea and reflects on the walls and ceilings. He favours minimalism, doesn't keep much in his house. He's very precise, this husband, neat and orderly. He likes that I'm not like this. He likes that I am artistic, messy, even chaotic at times. He likes to think he can smooth my rough edges with his clean, scientific precision. I love staying with him. We walk along the beach in the wind, watching oyster catchers skittering in and out of the little waves that break on the foreshore. Sometimes, on a clear day, you can see pilot whales far out to sea. My sixth husband doesn't like me to stay for long, but he likes for us to be in almost constant contact. He gave me this device. Here it is, see? No, it's not a mobile phone. I think it's some sort of tracker, something they use a lot in oceanography. Can you see the garden any better now that the sun is coming out? Those tulips over there look nice in the light, don't they? We planted them all when we moved here. I say we, but it was all me. It took a long time, but it's worth it. Yes, they really are that huge and nearly impossible to grow. They're quite rare too. Take a good look. They'll be gone soon. My seventh husband is vicious and manipulative, and if he shows up while you're here, you should hide, or better still, slip out the French windows into the garden. I'll distract him. No, honestly, don't worry, I'm not expecting him for hours. My eighth husband is much nicer, more dependable, and much older than me. He has white hair that springs back from his forehead. He's very serious, but wise and calm, too. We walk for hours together over fields and woodland. He likes to talk about philosophy. My mind wanders as he talks. I let his voice wash over me like music as we move through slices of evening sunshine. He's had the same pair of shoes for 30 years. No, he doesn't live here. They don't all live here with me. That would be absurd. I met my ninth husband last year. He's tall and drinks heavily. He's the sort of person who wears novelty clothes all the time. A sweatshirt made of neon faux fur, brightly coloured trainers, slogan t-shirts. When I first met him, he was dancing wildly at a party. He noticed me and pulled me towards him. This husband smiles and jokes all the time, even when he's sober. He's a clown, a lovable fool. Most women don't look twice at him, not because he's unattractive, but because he is loud, drunk, ridiculous, prone to clumsiness. But that's what I like most about him. He calls me princess, but he does it ironically. We laugh so hard that we cry sometimes. Once, he got really drunk and high, and he overheated and had a seizure on the dance floor of a nightclub. I went with him to hospital. The ambulance screeched through the cool morning air as dawn broke over the city. He cried like a baby when he regained consciousness, promised me he'd never scare me like that again. I need a rest now, a glass of water or something. Do you need anything? Let's open the windows and let the air in at least. Why don't you go out there and take a look at those tulips? Honestly, this is your last chance. The company doing the digitising says it'll look exactly the same, but I'll know. Just go out there for 5 minutes and have a proper look. Take a picture of them. You won't regret it. I didn't expect to meet my 10th husband so soon after the incident with my 9th. I had thought that perhaps I should slow down a little, take stock. But love finds you sometimes, doesn't it? It creeps up on you when you least expect it. Sometimes you're just walking along, minding your own business, or else looking out of the window on the train, and it comes at you, fluttering past you on the breeze. There's nothing you can do if love finds you. You just have to give in, let the current pull you under. No, that's not how I've met all my husbands. Many of them I've pursued, courted, researched, even stalked if I've had to. I'm not passive about finding them, but sometimes you have to give in to love if it comes hurtling towards you. My 10th husband is delicate, sensitive. He's not as tall or as handsome as some of my other husbands, but there's something in the curve of his cheekbones, the way he smiles radiantly but self-consciously. We met on the way to a conference. He sat next to me on the train. It was an ultra-fast one, you know, with a glass roof, and the sky sped past above our heads as we talked. We got drinks, realised we liked the same music. It felt easy, natural. He glanced out of the window and mentioned his significant other very quickly, as if he didn't really want me to hear. He wasn't wearing a ring, I noticed, but people don't nowadays, do they? When we arrived at the hotel where the conference was being held, we walked in together as though we were a couple. Instinctively, we both reached out for the other's hand but let go quickly, laughing, eyes sparkling. The hotel was a vast expanse of white, like a ship, with the flat blue sky behind it. Our rooms were on different floors, but he knocked on my door before dinner that first night. We were dressed formally for work, but I had put on perfume and lipstick. We walked past a wide mirror in the hotel lobby and I had to catch my breath when I saw our reflections. I could tell he did too. Have you ever been in love? Yes, all right. But have you ever fallen in love without meaning to? And have you ever loved more than one person at once? Have you ever loved a great many people, an infinite number, all at the same time? Well, I suppose not. No, otherwise you wouldn't be here asking me all these questions. I can't talk much more about husband number 10. We need to be careful or his significant other will find out. It would hurt my husband deeply if his significant other knew about me, and I can't bear the thought of him in pain. For this reason, we can't speak in person very often, but he leaves me messages, signs, to let me know he's thinking of me. Just the usual, you know, squiggles on walls, soft melodies, cloud formations, tea leaves, things like that. It's kindest that way. I do think about his significant other from time to time. I'm not a monster. I'm not. I know that the significant other looks very beautiful, and I picture them sometimes lying in bed next to one another as my husband sleeps peacefully. I imagine the significant other's eyes wide open in the dark, tears pooling in the corners. Husband 21 is broad and confident with a kind smile. He plays basketball professionally. He has boundless energy, smooth skin, strong shoulders, long dark eyelashes. I watch him sleeping sometimes, and I stay as quiet as possible, holding my breath so he doesn't wake up. Husband 148 is vast, as wide as he is tall. He's exceptionally good at maths and can solve riddles better than anyone else I know. He's an absolute riot at parties. There's another, I forget which number now, who has long limbs. He looks like a daddy long legs. He can juggle and ride a unicycle at the same time. He has an unpredictable streak, something erratic and undiscoverable under all that jollity, though. Stay away from him if you can. I haven't seen husband 86 for years, but we are connected by a thin silver thread. It's almost invisible and many miles long. I miss him, but it's comforting to know that he's there at the end of that thread, and I could heave and pull him to me if ever I needed him. There are more I could tell you about. I could go on for hours and hours. I can see them all now if I shut my eyes, all lined up neatly like binary code, stretching out forever. Imagine any husband, and he has been mine, or is mine, or will be. No, it's fine. I'm not tired. I can see that the light's going, though, is it? Or is it just me? I'll continue. You don't mind, do you? This is the last of these gardens. Everything will be in the cloud soon. Are you listening? I was just saying that it'll all be gone soon. Gone and not gone, or whatever. It's hard to know anymore what's there and what's not there, isn't it? I suppose you're used to it. You've never known any better.
Thank you so much, Claire. I love that story. I think in many ways it's probably one of the more conventional stories in the collection, which is weird to say after hearing it be read out loud. But it definitely shares a lot with some of the others. Obviously, most notably, I think, is this sense of addressing the reader very directly. So I'm wondering what reader you had in mind when you did this. I know one writer once said that their ideal reader was kind of slightly less intelligent version of themselves who'd read the exact same books that they had.
Wow.
So who is the ideal reader of your stories?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think I've never thought about that ever. And actually, now that the book is done, like, or even like when a piece is published in a journal, maybe this sounds really kind of corny, but it kind of just belongs to whoever is reading it at that point in time. You know, I definitely didn't sit down and write this thinking this is for these people, because ultimately I think it's my strange reflection of the world, you know. So I also, it's kind of for anyone with whom it resonates and who kind of finds something in it and who it speaks to. But yeah, I mean, people who are, I think it's probably obvious, maybe it's not obvious, but I think if you're interested in the kind of weirdness of the current times, it's probably a book for you.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the genesis of the stories. Jamie touched on some of the themes and the ideas that kind of broadly tie together, but I was wondering what the sort of driving force for you to do this was.
So it came about in the spring of 2020, when everybody was, you know, having a great time in lockdown, #1. And I think I'd wanted to write a book that was, I knew I wanted to write like a book about climate and nature, but a fiction book. And I wanted it to be a collection of short stories. So I knew that. And I think I'd had this idea outlined that I wanted to go and, you know, consider landscapes in the British Isles and how they might be. So it's kind of futuristic, but kind of near futuristic. And obviously, you know, any ability to go and travel anywhere or kind of like engage directly with landscapes was completely curtailed by the lockdown. And also the idea of writing a kind of near future, won't this be unsettling type of, you know, I suppose climate fiction or
people had other concerns at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, shall I write about an imagined horrible future or shall we just look around us? So I had to really like kind of take stock and think about what it was going to be. And I think I spent a long time kind of faffing around, not a long time, but a considerable amount of time kind of having, like, being a bit stuck. And then actually I wrote Infinite Husbands, which kind of started out like a weird, it was kind of an in-joke with my writing group, because my friend Joshua Jones, who's a very talented short story writer, misheard
Dylan
me.
Dylan Thomas,
shortlistee. And he, on one of our first kind of hangouts, he misheard, I don't know what it was that I'd said, but he'd misheard me and thought that I had said, I've got lots of husbands. And so it just became this kind of running joke. And then there's a story Kafka story called My 11 Sons, which is essentially where he writes, he's writing these little blocks about his sons, and there's 11 of them, and they're all metaphors for stories that he can't finish. So I kind of just, those two things kind of came together, and I wrote this, and then I was like, oh, this voice, I like this voice, I like this kind of unsettling voice. And actually the unsettling voice seemed to reflect most accurately like the kind of feelings that I was kind of having at the time. And then from there, everything just kind of, it kind of clicked into place. It was more about writing from a sensation and kind of visual images rather than kind of planning stuff out. I think that was when I realized I was terrible at planning and I should just write from the kind of emotional state. So then it was just strange things in nature, strange confluences of technology and nature. And it was just a kind of gut feeling to go towards. And then they all kind of shuffled into place kind of weirdly organically over that time, but in this very fraught and frenzied way where I was like, I'm writing a book and it's like the pandemic and everything's really weird, like what's the point? And then, do you know what I mean? So it was a slightly, yeah.
Doing your PhD at the time as well?
No, that was my master's. So we only had a year and it was all online. So it was like I had to complete this. And then I was just like completely obsessive and like, I need to stay doing this. So then the year after I then started doing my PhD. So yeah, I'm now writing more weird stories for that. So yeah.
Where did because obviously Infinite Husbands was the first story you wrote for the collection then?
Pretty much, yeah. There are versions of other things, like Wreck Event started off as something else. And then there's the story at the start about called a dream reading, like the dream part of that I'd written, but they were much earlier iterations. Infinite Husbands was the one where I was like, yes, I'm going to write like this now.
So where did because as you say, the confluence of nature and technology and all these things, that doesn't necessarily feature that heavily in Infinite Husbands, but you know, in the rest of the collection, I noticed particularly in Wreck Events, one example of this is just the really, you know, the freaking uncanny quality of birds is being utilized heavily in these stories. So when did the more environmental aspects start to come into it? Was that alongside the PhD or?
Well, no, I knew that I wanted to write an invite, like a book about the environment, a book about nature. But I come from, you know, I don't come from any sort of scientific background around that. And I think it was just something that I was really interested in. And I did a module on my master's about writing in the environment with Richard Kerridge, who is now my PhD supervisor. And it was just, it was just one of those academic moments where you're really inspired by the kind of breadth of what, you know, writing in place and writing the environment can be. It doesn't just have to be, you know, there's lots of really beautiful nature writing, but I think I was trying to see what happened when you kind of mashed a few things together. And I just, yeah, and I think the dead birds thing, you know, so then I read this news article about in North Wales about how there were these dead birds all over the road one morning. And I have a family member who lives in that area of Wales and she confessed, she was like, oh yeah, yeah, that's really strange. No one knew what happened. Yeah, so I think just these kind of looking for these odd moments, and then I'd be known for it. So then my friends would be like, oh, I've just found this article about an octopus that can count to 10 or something, like, you know? So I'm just getting these weird things like from people being like, you'll do a story about this probably, won't you? Yeah. I was like, all right, yeah, fine.
And always short stories, because we noted earlier when I kind of read out your protracted bio, which I apologise for, because I know how painful that can be.
But no, that's fine.
You also write poetry, you know, prose poems you mentioned as part of your research, you know. Everyone is always asking, why don't you do a novel?
Yeah.
You know, and also everyone always asks short story writers, why short stories?
Yeah.
Have you developed a kind of good go-to answer for that question?
Yeah, I'm like, because it's the best form.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about this on my journey over here. Like, so I'm really obsessive about the short story form, like from early, like as a child, I really liked those.
From young.
Yeah, from young. I really liked I've always really loved the form. I mean, I do read novels as well, but I think I'm fascinated by the way in which lots of writers say they're the hardest thing to write, and I like a challenge, so there's that. But I think you can be more dexterous emotionally, I think, in a collection of short stories. And I think the same applies to poetry as well. A lot of what I kind of think about in my PhD research is like, because I feel like the eco-poetics is, there's a lot going on there that's really interesting, and how that can be brought into short prose, you know, how those ideas, how those sensations can be brought into short prose. But yeah, I mean, I think it is incredible. I probably have, because obviously people know my book's coming out soon, and I have people come up to me and go, oh, congratulations on your book. I hate short stories.
Really?
Yeah, no, I've had two people in the last month say, and they're not being mean. I think they're almost saying, I've ordered your book. Just kind of people I know on the, you know, in but life.
Literary people or?
No, God, no. Yeah. But readers, like people who are readers, or I mean, in a couple of cases, people who read a lot, you know, people who would go to
read
book clubs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you then find yourself really defending them. And I'm just like, you don't really hate short stories, though. Like, what you're saying is that, like, you don't, you know, it's kind of this spiral where they're less marketable, they're perceived to be less marketable, so they're less kind of prevalent in, you know, they're not front and centre in bookshops, so people don't pick them up, they're not reviewed as much. And, yeah, so then people just aren't exposed to them as much, so...
I mean, I feel like poetry is even lower down that kind of hierarchy.
Yeah, I think I read, I can't remember, you've probably come across this, there's like, you know, the number of people that read poetry that don't write it is minuscule.
Yeah, it's all the kind of pyramid scheme kind of writing and selling poetry, because the only people you're selling to are the people who have either taught you or you teach or also read it or also write it. Yeah,
but then I think, you know, but then where do we go when we have a kind of moment like a wedding or a funeral or whatever, you know, like that's, you go to poetry. So is this straight, and it's the same with short stories to a degree. I think it's like we communicate in short stories, like, you know, Instagram posts and, you know, anecdotes and news articles.
Like, yeah. All the myth stuff as well. You know?
Yeah. And I think it's really, it is funny when people go, oh no, I like a novel because I like to really get into it. And I'm like, but a short story collection is the same length, like, you know, this is the same length as a novel. You're getting your money's worth. But I don't know. It is a really interesting. So I feel really kind of tenacious about that. And I have lots of ideas at the same time. So the idea of having to put all of those to the side and commit to one idea to write about for, like, you know, a couple of years to deliver a novel, it scares the absolute shit out of me. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear, but but it does. I'm just like, I'd have to, and I don't kind of discount the idea that I may have an idea for a novel that I love so much that I want to do it, but it hasn't happened yet. So yeah, until then, I'm going to keep doing this, and my PhD does kind of focus solely on short fiction, so I'm good until that's done, until people can stop badgering me about writing a novel.
I'm curious about what it's like to write these sort of high concept stories. I mean, the beauty of a short story is that you don't have to necessarily complete these ideas or have them as sort of fully rounded. You can leave things suspended and questions unanswered in the way that you need to with a novel. And I'm curious to know where you feel a need to sort of stop yourself to let the mystery lie, kind of feeding into that uncanny voice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. I think because your time investment for a reader reading a short story is obviously much less, you can leave them hanging in a way that it would feel kind of mean doing in a novel. You know, you do have to. But then I think when you're writing about the kind of environment and the climate emergency, and even doing it in a kind of fictional way, there really isn't a kind of conclusion to any of that. So it kind of resists the typical plot arc, I think, for a novel. So you can kind of do away with that in a short story, which is quite nice. So I start in terms of the kind of concepts, and I think I sort of start with an image or a kind of mood. And then normally I think I have a tendency to leave it too oblique, and then my writing group will just be like, yeah, you probably need to give them a little bit more here. Just like, so yeah, so I think I like that suspenseful, I like the suspensefulness, but I think it, I mean, and a lot of short writers of short fiction will do this, you know, they'll leave you with some kind of big thing right at the end and snap it shut. And I feel like, this was one of the concerns I had with this collection, is I don't just want that to be repeated. So one of the things I'm doing now in my new project is kind of thinking about how you trade off. And normally it's kind of humour and pleasurable moments, I think, like, you know, so it's not just bleak and then tense and then done. Like George Saunders is really good for that, for example.
Yeah.
Like 10th of December is amazing because it's like they're really playful, interesting, rich stories with lots of like human tenderness, but there, and then he is able then to give you like full weird.
And he varies up the length as well, because it's like, you know, in 10th of December, the third story is like a page long.
One sticks.
I remember reading that for the first time. That absolutely floored me.
I read that every now and again, and I'm just like, So simple. Just write a story like this and you'll be great. And like, oh, yeah. It's just, yeah, it's amazing. That whole collection is just, that was one of the ones actually that I read very early on when I kind of started writing properly. And I was just like, yeah, I can do this. I think I can I can't do it, but like, I reckon I want to try and do that, you know?
Did you read his book about the form of the short story?
Yeah.
What did you think?
I thought it was good actually. Yeah. I mean, it's useful. I've got it. I kind of go back and forth with it. I like seeing that deconstruction in a way. I'm kind of a bit like, I don't want things to be demystified too much, you know, so I don't read a lot of craft books, but I'll make an exception for him.
So earlier you mentioned you were obsessed with the short story from an early age, which is, I'd say, not a particularly common occurrence, but one man who I know who is obsessed with the short story, who came on this podcast, in fact, is obviously Tom from Scratch Books.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested to know at what point Scratch Books became involved with the collection. You know, you first wrote Infinite Husbands in 2020. Over the next couple of years, presumably you were writing all the rest of the stories. When did you think about finding a publisher, and why them?
Well, so it was done kind of, the whole collection was written quite fast. I mean, drafted initially quite fast, so it was done. I'd started it in the sort of the March of 2020. It was done by the end of the year, and then I was sending it out to agents at the start of 2021. I was ghosted by every single one, like not one, not even a rejection.
Not even
like
a reply?
No, none, honestly.
Come on, agents.
But then I was like, I probably won't need an agent. I'm just going to go off and do my own thing. But then my agent Ludo found me like a year after that, which was great because he'd kind of seen, I think he'd read My Brain Is Boiling With Ideas, which was the story that got shortlisted for White Review, and I'd had some other things from the collection published then. And so, yeah, so Scratch kind of came through that kind of round of submissions of Ludo sending it out. And I knew Tom anyway. We'd actually met at the White Review. We did readings for the shortlisting. And so we kind of been like professional chatting a bit, but it's been really nice to work with someone I think who, like, he's absolutely committed to the form and vet has a lot of energy for for the press. And I think it definitely suits me very well because I'm quite uncompromising. So, which is what, like, when I said to Ludo before he signed me, I was just like, look, I can't, I'm like, I have to like work in this way. Like, my work's quite weird. I don't know if I'm ever going to make you any money. He's like,
what do you mean by uncompromising then?
Well, I suppose because like, I don't want to turn anything into a novel. Like, I'm not, I don't know if I'm going to write anything long form. I don't know if like, I don't want to make it less experimental.
You're not chasing a Booker Prize, No,
I mean, it's writing in the way that I want to write is sort of the most important thing to me. I'm always a bit surprised when people are like, yeah, that's great. I'm like, okay, then we'll work together then, I suppose. But yeah, Tom's very accommodating of me. Yeah, the editorial process has been quite collaborative. Like, you know, there are a few stories where he's been like, I think you should totally overhaul this one. And I'm like, no, but I will do this instead. So like Rec Event, for example, which is the story about the dead birds in North Wales, like it's got loads of footnotes. So it's like one voice and then it has footnotes where the other voice kind of exists. And it was only the one voice for a while. And Tom was kind of going, oh, I think there's more needs to happen with this. And I was like, I don't want to rewrite it because I actually really like it. So then I did that and actually was like, yeah, this is, yeah, you were right. That's what you should do. So I think, yeah, it's nice to have that kind of, to be on a sort of equal footing with an editor, I think, because I think, yeah, it suits us.
I think going back to Rec Event, it's one of the ones we were talking about in prep for the podcast. It's a really sort of experimental form. And I'm just wondering if what drew you to that and if it's something you'd like to do more of in the future.
Did the concept come first? Because you mentioned the dead bird story. So that came before the idea of the footnotes.
Yeah. So it didn't have the footnotes before.
So the footnotes were completely added up to the conversation.
So I think that was Tom's question. Tom was like, why don't we hear from this guy? Is there more we can do with the other characters? And I was kind of going like, yeah, but I don't know. I liked the fact that it was kind of being told in the second person. It was being told in retrospect, because like something had happened and it was all over. So I didn't want to Yeah, and I think I love a footnote. I really do love a footnote. It's great. There's lots of writers that I really admire that do it.
Hate it when people send us footnotes in submissions to the London magazine, because it's just, we can't integrate them in our mag. So don't do that.
Okay. Sorry, why not? Why not? Why is it so difficult? Just your templates that you use.
Well, just in InDesign, I just don't want to have to go through that process.
Just laziness, Jamie.
Essentially, yeah.
Not on. Yeah. Well, that's sad.
I've never been convinced enough. Besides, in your story, of course.
Oh yeah. See, there you go. And what if I'd, I mean, so that the old version was published by The Lonely Crowd a couple of years ago. So, and again, I sort of didn't, and I like a footnote for lots of reasons. I like this kind of interjecting little voice, this kind of like picky voice that kind of exists in the bottom of the page, kind of having their right of reply, but like not really kind of taking precedence. And I think, yeah, that's why it's really interesting and useful to think about like poetic form when writing prose, because the way it looks on the page is, can make loads of difference to prose fiction. And I get really excited, like Camilla Gradova's The Doll's Alphabet that I read recently. It's like there's footnotes there, little kind of asides, little kind of strange formal techniques going on that I think are overlooked in prose fiction, because people are, you know, looking at the content more, which is good, but I think it's good to play around with these things.
I mean, I think it has interesting implications for kind of autofiction and that story particularly, you know, the kind of selective memory aspect of that you seem to be playing with.
Yeah.
I do wonder how much of your own life makes it into these stories that are so, you know, based around apparently your writing group saying, here's an octopus with eight, you know,
yeah,
you can speak in French or something.
Yeah, my whole, that's all 100% true. No, I think like probably all writers, there are degrees and elements of things that have happened and feelings. I think I'm interested in like conveying emotion as accurately as possible. So,
like,
I didn't get a quartz stuck under my hand, and like I didn't, like I don't have infinity husbands, but I think I'm kind of thinking about, you know, feelings of like grief and loss and discomfort and like unlucky in love or being rejected. And
I mean, even romance and infinite husbands, is it the 10th husband?
Yeah.
I mean, that,
oh, he's lovely.
It's moving in a very genuine way, you know?
Yeah. I think that's what I'm kind of trying to convey, is that I'm evasive or something, but I feel like I feel more comfortable being more emotionally vulnerable if there's then this kind of veil of fiction. But then I do call every character in my book is called Claire. So people do, which was because in the early days, like when I started getting things published, a few people in my kind of extended family particularly would be like, is she okay? And I'd be like, what? And they'd be like, she's written this very disturbing story. So then I thought, I'm just going to lean into this and call them all Claire just to mess with people. So yeah, no, virtually untrue. It's fiction.
I was wondering if you, in your academic work, you would turn to Donna Haraway at all.
I've read her, yeah, a little bit, but not, people always mention her, but no, I haven't, not extensively. Talking about my academic work is probably not a great thing to do right now, because I'm like, I've neglected my PhD so much in favour of this book. So at the moment, it's just like me going like, eco-theory here and surrealist writing techniques here. And like, yes, they make sense together, do they? Yeah. Can I have a PhD now? Yeah, no. So like eco-critics, I really like Timothy Morton, and there's a theorist, I suppose she's called a cultural theorist. She calls herself a cultural theorist rather than a philosopher, called Astrida Nomanis, she writes about hydrofeminism. So this idea of bodies and water and porousness and how the kind of interconnectedness of water, because my new stuff is kind of more like marine based, but at the moment I am a bit concerned it does just feel like this book but like at the beach, so so we'll see how it differentiates when it's done. The Unreliable Nature Writer goes to the beach.
The beach would perhaps add another layer to it, but regardless of that, the stories are weird, you know. That's something I've thought about a lot, but weird and funny. And that's something I think that, you know, is really hard to do and also doesn't get spoken about that much. Like, these are amusing stories. Is that something you lead into? I mean, I know you personally, you're a funny guy, but you know what I mean? Like, how
yeah,
does
just,
that...
just can't help it, Jamie. Mm. Being funny is kind of a weird thing, isn't it? Because like people that...
Because George Saunders is funny, right?
Yeah.
But that can also be a stick to beat him with, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a chance, I get really worried that like I feel like I either lean very far into this very kind of serious talk about like, you know, the end of the world, or I am just very irreverent and offhand, and like that neither of those are particularly make for particularly good chat. But yeah, I mean, I like things that are strange and funny and kind of uncanny. I think like finding humour in the uncanny is like, yeah, is kind of where I like to write the most, and kind of, and like absurdity, I think, as well. Like, I keep referring to Kafka. So
I was going
to
say,
I think I'm a soft boy because I'm like Kafka.
I mean,
but I do like
the
that kind of
short stories.
Yeah,
there you go.
But where you're just like, I think that thing of like, is he all right? You know, like that that where it's the you know, you're not playing for laughs. You're not. You know, it's not comedy in the sense that you're kind of constructing something for laughs, but it's the kind of nervous laugh that I'm interested in, which I think, like, to be fair, like quite a lot of comedians do kind of cultivate that really, really well. And that's, you know, I think that's more of a kind of, I don't know, it's a deep human reaction, isn't it? Laughing.
It's a defense mechanism.
Yeah, totally. Level, yeah. Just like, ha ha. Yeah, so no, it's I don't know if I could do it. And the thing with Infinite Husbands, I think, was I was just kind of writing from a place of not trying to be a writer. You know, before I was like, I need to be this type of very serious writer in order to be taken seriously. And then with Infinite Husbands, I was just like, I'm just going to be weird and silly and not put too much pressure on it. And then that's where it starts to actually work properly. So I think that's the thing. I think all writers go through this. Maybe they don't, but I think a lot of writers that I know go through this process of being like, I want to be this type of writer. And then they're like, actually, I'm uncovering that I'm this type of writer. Mm. And they might be closely aligned and they might not, but...
You can't pick what you're good at, I think. That's
no, exactly. Thing. And you can't pick like how what's inside you and how... Like you can kind of just work to uncover it rather than trying to kind of... Because otherwise you're just trying to be something you're not.
What do you think people want to write about but are afraid to then? You know, as a member of writing groups, as someone who's spent a lot of time in your PhD presumably around other creative people doing creative practice, is there something you look at and think, you know, you're in denial here? Like, what is it? what are you wanting to write about but can't face? And is there anything that you feel you can't write about?
Oh, yeah, I can't write about, like, I can't write autofiction.
Yeah.
No, I'm just too exposing for me. And I wrote a piece recently for Lunate because they're doing a, I edit that magazine, although... have been neglecting them recently for this. I've been, Hannah, the managing editor, has put together this collection of stories to raise money for medical aid for Palestinians and commissioned a piece from me about motherhood. So I started off trying to write something like true about my experience of motherhood, and I just found myself obfuscating quite a lot of the detail. Well, no, I mean, it is true, but it's not kind of confessional. And so I think that's the thing. And I think... Yeah, I think like messiness of emotion is a thing. I don't think it's something people shy away from, but again, I think people are looking to maybe writers look to sort of sew things up or kind of be conclusive or something. And I mean, I think when you resist that or when you realise you don't have any answers maybe and that you don't really have the authority, then the writing becomes more interesting.
I think it's hard to write a lack of clarity well. Like it's hard to write messiness, you know, with clarity, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes, right? yeah, totally. I try and do it, but even I think you know, you are, as the writer of the book that someone's reading, there is an authorial voice, like, of course. So then you feel like, well, I've been given this privilege, this opportunity to say something to people. I should probably make it good, you know. I should probably make it kind of meaningful or something. And I think when you try and do that, then that's when it kind of becomes arch and perhaps disingenuous. And I definitely did that in the early days, and then I was just like, how about if I'm just really, if I just leave all the mess on the table and see if people like it, and they seem to. So that's a relief.
So no personal essays on the horizon then?
Oh, I don't know. Well, if you, they'll be really like sarcastic.
Happened to me, it was terrible, lol.
Yeah, you know. Lol, I've fallen over again, like that kind of thing, you know. So
And just as a final question, we like to ask our guests what they've been enjoying recently, whether that's an album, film, book, artwork. We just love to know what you're loving.
Oh, God.
Is your opportunity to gas some people up?
To gas some people up. Mm. Who shall I gas up? I've started reading. I've got a proof of Ellie Williams's new collection.
Oh, nice.
Which is really good. I'm so excited that she's done another collection of short stories, because A Trib is like the best. Like, I remember, again, along with that 10th of December, I remember reading A Trib and I was just like, are you allowed to do this? Like, are you allowed to be this kind of experimental and this strange? And I think, so that I'm really enjoying. Music, I'm nothing new or interesting. I literally just listen to like drone and bird noises when I'm like,
really?
Yeah, no, I really do. No, I don't, but like I have like, I listen to like ambient, like just nothing. Oh. I do not understand how one can, like, my partner listens to music when he writes, and I'm just like, how are you not just writing down the like words that you're hearing that they're singing? Like, doesn't make any sense to me.
I feel like if you know a song well enough, because I listen to like exclusively music with lyrics probably when I write as well, and I need some noise.
I don't want any bass, I don't want any nostalgia, I don't want any memory, I don't want any kind of like, yeah, I'm just like, no, just you know, endless noise. And then yeah, and what else? Film.
Are you giving us the full house?
No, like, I'm not. No, please, I'm not going to give you a film. No, I'm not going to give you a film because I'm just thinking about the last film I watched, which was Saltburn, which was like hilariously bad.
Have you got any takes on Saltburn? I fucking hated that so deeply.
Did you?
This is now the second time it's come up on a podcast. Oh, my God.
Did it come up on the last one?
With Dan Sparren.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just hated it on...
Well, cinematographically, very beautiful.
But even that, in a very TikTok way,
the images composed
were so... It's like, okay, of course you've done that. Like,
I'd read all the discourse before watching it, and me and Gary agreed that, like, the Barry Keoghan...
I think he carries him.
Why?
Because he can only do one thing, which is, I'm kind of weird and potentially a sex criminal, but also
tricky little man.
Do we want to talk about his like attempted Scouse accent in that film, which is abominable as well? Why not just make him Irish?
That was weird that he wasn't Irish, that they didn't make him Irish, because that would have been far more appealing. Exactly. Well, not that I don't like a Scouse accent, but like, no, I thought if it weren't for him, it would have been, and also I thought Rosamund,
Jacob Elordi was amazing. No, I love Jacob Elordi.
Yeah,
he's so beautiful to look at.
Yeah, see, this is where you and I differ, because I'm far more into Barry.
Really interesting. What about you, Katie? Settle the score.
Yeah, come on. Just go straight down the middle.
Elordi or Barry?
I don't fancy either of them. I'm really sorry.
Oh,
wow.
But
if you had to,
do you know what? I think because I've seen, I think I've seen loads of photos with Barry Keoghan. He's had filler recently, and he's looking.
Lip filler.
He's had face filler. Sorry, Barry.
Has he not just had a weird face?
Yeah,
I think you can see it. Young man.
He photos of him at the Met Gala with his partner. They look increasingly similar. I'm convinced of this.
Oh, I like that though. That's weird.
Please don't sue us, Barry.
Yeah.
You can't sue us for that.
I'm saying complimentary things as well. I think. Yeah. Anyway. So yeah. So it was. I'd read everything about it already, so I knew what happened. So it was just. It was silly and funny. Like, I think if I was going to watch it, being like, this is going to be intensely amazing cinema, I'd have been disappointed, but because I knew it was kind of camp, like, you know,
whatever,
Twitter fodder.
Right, as a rogue final question then, which I just thought of, you know, God bless the person who's trying to adapt short stories generally, but if there was a short story in this collection to be adapted to a film, you can't do Infinite Husbands, because obviously that kind of exists, or maybe you could. Maybe that could be interesting, like all these different men kind of flitting about. That could be a short film.
I don't know.
They're not there.
I'd say probably My Brain Is Boiling With Ideas has the most like heft in it, and the most sort of characters narrative and family and things like that. And the setting's nice, like the marshes as a setting is a nice place. So, yeah, God. I mean, like the fact that this is a book and people want to read it, I'm already like, what? The idea that somebody would ever want to make into a film. Just like, yeah, have it. Do what you like. This is amazing. Yeah, it's going to audiobook as well, so that will be
very nice.
Are you doing the audiobook narration?
No, someone competent voice actor. Yeah, it's Margot Robbie. Yeah, no, it's Stephen Fry actually. No, she is a voice actor. I listened to lots of tapes, and that was very strange, kind of thinking, because I would have liked to have done it, but you're not always allowed. Some people are, some people aren't. But yeah, so it's really strange. is going to be really strange.
Were you involved in the process of picking her
out?
Oh,
yeah, 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 yeah. And I had to brief as well on, like, what sort of age and what sort of accent and, you know, wow, that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's a very surreal moment, I think. Like, yeah, thinking about that coming out, which I think is coming out at the same time as the book.
On Spotify?
Yeah, Spotify, yeah.
There you go. Well, you can find Unreliable Nature Writer at Scratch Books. You can find it on Spotify soon as well. Mm-hmm. You can find the London Magazine on social media at the London Mag, Instagram, Twitter, etc. You can also subscribe to our magazine for £40 per year for 6 print issues. And if you'd like to pre-order our new June, July issue, we have one of Claire's stories in there just before the release of the book, There or Not There, which is, I think, my favourite story in the collection. It's incredible, and I'm very much looking forward to our readers having it in the new issue. You can find everything about the London Magazine at our website, londonmagazine.org. Katie, Claire, thank you so much, and I'm really excited to see this book be released.
Thank you.